Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Alt Reports Radio, where we talk with folks about investing in alternative assets outside of the 60/40 stocks and bonds portfolio. Today I'm on here with Einar Volset. And Einar, we've known each other for a long time. I know exactly what you do over there, I think. Yep. I'm going to ask you to just tell us a little bit about your businesses. And I think you've got two going right now, and one of them I want to dig into, but correct me, maybe there's more that I don't know about.
As of right now, yeah, there's only two. I like to say that I have the most hated title, both on the East Coast and the West Coast. I'm a venture capitalist and an investment banker. It's the worst of all worlds. No, we're focused on B2B SaaS. Sorry, what?
I said your kind is good around here. We accept it.
There you go. Mm-hmm. No, we focus on B2B SaaS. On the investment banking side, I founded Discretion Capital, which does...
Back up one second. B2B SaaS. SaaS software is a service. And that means that you've got to fund you're investing solely into businesses that are building software as a service businesses for...
These are like your boring, like... You go to work, you have to use some software in order to achieve your job. That's what we deal with, basically. Effectively, on the M&A side, our job is to sell those businesses. We typically represent businesses between 2 and 10 million ARR. ARR being annual recurring revenue. This is one of the key features of B2B SaaS, is the sort of recurring revenue subscription basis. And then on the investor side, I'm part general partner at TinySeed, which is basically a super early stage venture fund that invests in those kind of companies at the earliest stages. And we're into fund, I guess, three now. And I think by the time this time comes out, we will have invested in more than 100 companies from that fund.
Wow.
And we invest very early there. We invest at as early as 500. A month in recurring revenue. So kind of truly the earliest stage. And really the difference between our thesis and like your standard Silicon Valley VC is we've tried to design the investment structure in such a way that the investors and us and the founders will all succeed if, there's an exit in the 20 million, 50 million, $100 million exit. Instead of your typical VC, which the only goal is to IPO and become a $1 billion unicorn or decacorn or whatever. So that's kind of the key difference. And effectively, what we believe is that there are many more, $100 million exits than there are $1 billion exits, or indeed $10 billion exits.
So in the kind of market that we're in right now, where NASDAQ and a lot of the tech stocks on there just getting crushed, how are these kinds of investments any different from that, other than that they're early stage?
Well, I mean, being early stage certainly helps in many ways. I think we're seeing on the M&A side and certainly on the fundraising side too, that the closer you are to the public markets, the harder you and earlier you're getting crushed in terms of comparisons to the public multiples. The interesting thing about SaaS really is like, It doesn't have the, even in like a recessionary environment, which, arguably we're in, people don't cancel their business software. They still kind of have to use it. I'm actually working on a piece right now that's some analysis of the impacts of the recession and how that's going to impact both our own portfolio, but also starting to look at some of the more public SaaS companies, just to compare SaaS, B2B SaaS in general, to more consumer facing products, whether that's software or media or whatever. From what I'm seeing, just sort of anecdotally, but also, and who knows how long the current environment's going to last, but currently we're actually not seeing that huge an impact in terms of growth. There's, I think around May, June timeframe, there was I think across the board, a jump in churn. So an increase in cancellations basically, but, I suspect from talking to founders that a lot of that was basically customers like actively looking at their subscriptions and being like, what are we actually using? So at any given point, because it's sort of a recurring software business, like you subscribe to it and you put your credit card in or whatever, and then you're getting billed every month, there's a certain percentage of your customers most of the time that basically aren't using your software very much. Mm. And coming into like when the NASDAQ's down 30% and everyone's talking about recessions and interest rates are up, people start worrying, companies start worrying much more about what should we cut, what can we cut now. And I certainly think we saw a bump of that churn in sort of the May, June timeframe. But in many ways, I think that stuff that would have churned out anyway, like over the next 6 to 12 months, is just that, you know, it focused everyone's mind over the summer that we need to be a little bit more prudent with cash going forward. So although it's soon, and I probably won't come out with this until the new year, you know, maybe late next year, is to look at like, you know, what is the impact? What is the resiliency of those kind of revenue streams compared to, you know, something more consumer facing? I certainly think you're much more likely to see a direct impact in other businesses than you are in sort of B2B SaaS. It's much more the plumbing of business, as they were.
So in software in general, there's been sort of this like growth at any cost kind of theme, and we're worried about profitability later. Tell me how you think about profitability for the folks in your, what do you call them? Would you call it a, you just call it in your fund? It's a mentorship program as well as there is.
Yeah. So we run it. I mean, we call it our portfolio. Like we basically run accelerator batches, like a year long accelerator for our fully remote for our portfolio companies. And so we do two of those every year, one, you know, Europe-based, one North America-based. We focused on B2B SaaS mostly because part of the thesis around how we invest is that we don't really want a lot of dilution. So we believe that most of these B2B SaaS companies, if you look at, I mean, some of my private equity friends who work in more traditional businesses don't believe me when I say this, but they can have, you know, 90, 95% gross margins at scale once they get past a million or two. And it's not unusual for a business that's doing more than a million or two in ARR to have free cash flows of 35, 40, maybe even 50%. And so, and in fact, I think you see that reflected in some of the more well-known public B2B SaaS companies as well. So for example, the example I like to give is Zoom, which everyone knows. They actually, when they IPO'd, they had more cash in the bank than they'd raised before going public. And it speaks to the capital efficiency of those type of businesses. Yeah, and there are many of them who are like that. Like Slack actually is another example where I don't know if they quite had that much cash, but it was sort of on the order of that. And so in terms of profitability, like the goal for us when we run our accelerators, which run 12 months, is it's not the traditional, you know, do it for 3 months, then try to raise as much money as possible at as high a valuation as possible, which is your YC or your tech stars. For us, it's like we want them to be default alive and so that they can get to a revenue range where they have all their optionality. They could go raise some money, but it's enough to pay salaries. They cover expenses. It's basically break even at that point. And you know, if they have, you know, reason to believe that more capital would be beneficial in terms of growing faster or the opportunities larger, then they go out and raise money. But if not, they don't do that. And so I think unusually in our portfolio, we're seeing like 30-ish percent of companies raising some kind of financing after us.
Okay.
Versus like, if you were a traditional venture fund, that would be disastrous because that would mean that 70% of your portfolio was basically dead. Mm. Versus for us, even of the successful ones, a lot of them don't raise any more money because they don't need to. And so they choose not to. And so you as an investor, you know, instead of being in a position where, okay, you invest at the pre-seed seed stage, maybe you own 10%, then by the time, you know, it IPOs, you own 0.25% because they've gone through all the letters in the venture, you know, series financing alphabet. You still maybe own 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe even 10% in an exit event or a liquidity event. And then also like particularly now, and I mean, who knows what's going to happen with the new interest rate regime, but certainly in the B2B SaaS world, there are now many more sort of financing things available to you. So like things like revenue-based financing, you're talking about like non-dilutive means,
as opposed
to debt financing, basically. Mm-hmm. Right, and so that doesn't dilute you, but you can do things like using PIPE, where because there's such predictable revenue streams, you can say, okay, I'm getting paid, I don't know, $10,000 a month, but you can use something like PIPE or, you know, Light of Capital, whatever, to say, okay, I want to get basically borrow 12 months from that revenue stream. So if you have something very specific in terms of like, here's a paid acquisition channel that works, something like that, you can pull that revenue forward without further diluting your cap table.
Hmm. So talk to me a little bit about, other than that they're in B2B SaaS and they're, you know, 500 MRR, which is monthly recurring revenue or better, what are some of the other filters that you apply when you're looking at, I assume you're looking at, if you've got 100, you must be looking at maybe many hundreds or thousands of companies to invest in, yeah?
Yeah, we probably look at 400 or 500 companies a year. To make our determination. It really depends. So one of the sort of alpha and omegas when it comes to these kind of businesses is churn rate. So like, you know, do you have the kind of, because again, this depends on specifically whether you're what's called vertical or horizontal software. So what is your churn rate? Like when do people cancel? How often do people cancel this software? And what you really want ideally is something that's super sticky, where, you know, you bring a customer in, maybe they only pay you, I don't know, $50, $100, $250 a month, but they're sort of a core operational part of your business. So you're not going to cancel them. So you just stay with them for years and years. And so we definitely do look at that, even at the earliest stages. And, you know, 500 is pretty low for us. It's sort of the sweet spot. It's more like 3,000-4,000 up to maybe 15,000-20,000.
Okay.
And that gives us, like, once you're into that revenue range, that gives us enough data that we can look at, like, what is the churn rate for this product? Like, are people sticking around? And we find that particularly for vertically integrated SaaS, so this would be software used to run a car dealership or a dental software, dental company or something like that. It should be pretty sticky. Like it might be a kind of a long sales cycle in some cases, just to get it, convince them that they should stop using pencil or paper or Excel or whatever.
Sure.
But once they're starting using it, it's a key part of their stuff. And so they pretty much don't churn in some cases. That's slightly different for depending on what you're doing. So, you know, like if you're selling SaaS software to e-commerce merchants, for example, you're going to have a higher level of churn just because turns out there's a lot of people in this world who think they're going to become billionaires, you know, selling random crap on Shopify.
Sure.
And so they'll start a drop shipping site selling something from Alibaba. And then 3 months later, they realize they're losing money. So they shut it down. And there's really nothing as a software vendor to that merchant that you could do to not churn, because they're basically shutting their business down. So we do take that into account. But certainly, that's one of the biggest red flags for us. It's like if the churn is significantly higher than you would expect, given the segment they're in, the kind of software it is.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about like how folks invest with you. And I know I don't think you've got a round that you're raising right now, but what types of, like, how many investors do you have? What types of people are good investors for Tiny Seed? What are they looking for? Like, what are they expecting, you know, in the long run? And kind of walk me through how people think about investing in this stuff.
Sure. I mean, our goal is still to like to come in and be, you know, a top quartile, have performance of a top quartile venture fund.
What's
venture
that mean?
Funds themselves are actually very similar to startups in themselves, and that there's a very big variation between, like, I think actually the average venture fund loses money, so you get less money back than you put in. Top quartile performance probably puts you into a 3x range versus, okay, like top 10%, all of a sudden you're talking 20 times your money back. And so very much our goal is to go after that kind of return, because, you know, we're investing in early stage software businesses. These are, you know, high risk, hopefully high reward investments. And so we're not a debt fund. There's no like guaranteed redemptions. There's no cash flows that's going to start coming after a certain amount of time. It's more like you're putting the money in and you're sort of hoping slash expecting that you get 3, 5, 10 times your money back 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years from now. So most of our investors at the moment, we're a reasonably small fund. I think we have 50, 60 million AUM, something like that. Most of our funds is like 10 to 25, $30 million range. And most of our investors actually are sort of high net worth individuals and family offices rather than, you know, most of the big VCs like your Andreessen Horowitz, your Sequoia Capital, they're getting their money from pension funds and big university endowments. A funny story, I was actually at a LPGP, so LP would be limited partner, conference in New York a couple of weeks ago. And they were like, I was talking to the guy from, I think it was New York State Pension Fund. And he was like, yeah, our minimum check size is $250 million. I was like, that's great. Can you just drop it in 10 and give me one piece of that? Like, you know, let's just get that done.
Sure.
So most of our investors are that. We actually have a lot of our investors, probably more than 50%, are sort of been there, done that, operators. So they're like, they bootstrapped, started their own software business. You know, they sold it to private equity. Now they have a bunch of cash. And like, they're like, well, I don't want to put all my money in real estate, even though that seems what everyone's doing. Like, I want to, you know, give back to that community and invest in something I understand. And we like that just because obviously their money is as green as anyone else's, but also they have their own, you know, they have their own networks and they have their own advice that we very much rely on in terms of, you know, hooking up the founders that we back with those kinds of advice and those kinds of mentors. So that's been working out really well. But yeah, like in terms of just mechanics, like we're a pretty standard VC fund. That means 2 and 20 basically. So we take 2% on average, 2% of funds under management and fees that goes to pay, you know, salaries or accelerator, you know, that's the programming for the founders. And then, after sort of a 1x liquidation, a return hurdle, we take 20% of profit on top of that.
Okay. And I assume, you know, we're talking about having to build companies and exit from them. I assume we've got a lockup or a hold period that's pretty long. Yeah.
Yeah. The funds themselves are like, you know, 10 years long with, you know, I think 1 or 2 years of extension built in there. You know, because we're backing such early stage companies, like you don't really want them. Like if you start getting distributions in year 1 or 2 or 3, chances are things are not going well because these businesses most of the time in year 2 are just not big enough to have any kind of meaningful outcome. So what I tell in potential investors is like you really shouldn't expect any kind of money back whatsoever until like year 5 or 6. Just because, you know, that's the kind of time frame it takes to build these businesses up to a size where, you know, you're getting into 2 million, 5 million, 10 million in revenue, where it makes sense to start to sell them, like whether to private equity or to more strategic buyers out there. So certainly, like if you're an investor who's looking for more dependable, you know, cash flows, you know, that sort of thing, we're not for you. You know, you should probably more look at it like a revenue-based financing debt fund or something like that. We're very much more the longer term, like we actually legally can't give you redemption rights. So we rely on the VC exemption with the SEC. And if we were to guarantee you, say, okay, after 2 years, you can get your money back or cash out or whatever, we would lose that exemption and actually probably have the SEC breathing down our necks. So it's a highly illiquid, highly risky investment, basically. But hopefully not quite as risky as your average VC fund because of the strategy.
Right. So I assume then, now that you've said the word SEC, I assume, let's talk about who's qualified. Is it an accredited investor and above investment with you guys?
Yeah, pretty much. So we looked at a couple of different, you know, mechanics to let, you know, retail investors come in, but it's almost impossible to do so just because the current regulatory regime. We're actually randomly working with, one of the challenges is there's like the accredited investor threshold that you need to meet. And actually for us, one of the largest issues is the SEC has this notion of you can only have 99 investors in any given fund. There's like a hard cap that's actually written into the law. And this is problematic because what ends up happening is that, you know, okay, that's fine if you're doing a smallish fund. So then maybe you're collecting $50,000 checks and it works out okay. But if you wanted to scale that and again, you know, basically build any kind of an enduring franchise in this world, then you need to raise slightly larger funds. So that's, you know, 25 million or whatever. But then at 99 LPs, the minimum investment becomes $250,000. And so that's a much harder ask, particularly as a first check from investors. And so one of the things we've been working on is, and honestly, like the sort of cynic in me looks at this and say, this suits the more traditional existing larger venture funds, you know, down to a T, because those guys have all the money anyway. They have the big funds, they have the existing things. And it's that basically is like regulatory capture for them. Like it makes it much harder to like, they'll let us play, like, you know, $5 million fund. That sounds fun. You go do that. But once you get into $25 million, $100 million funds, all of a sudden you have to start competing directly with them for the larger checks, even though maybe you have an investor base that would be willing to fund a $100 million fund. But you maybe have to take 200 investors, 300 investors to do that. That just isn't possible at the moment. So we're actually working with somebody to try to introduce on the Senate floor an amendment to that rule. And we actually got introduced on the Senate floor back in March or April. So we're hoping to get that limit lifted to 500, which would, you know, obviously help us, but also help other more upstart venture investors who maybe doesn't quite look the same or aren't your typical venture spin-off. So the way venture, and let me just rant about venture spin-offs.
Yeah.
There's all these stories that come out and it's like, oh, so-and-so raised their first venture fund and they raised $250 million. And you're like, wow, it's like two dudes or two women raised $250 million for their first fund. That's amazing. And then you look and it's like, oh, yeah, like they worked at Sequoia for 10 years. And so it's a spin-off of Sequoia and most of the money is the same money. Like it's the same people doing the same thing. It's just whatever. Yeah. Versus someone really truly starting from cold to raise that kind of fund, particularly for a fund one, is almost unheard of. And in part, it's because of the way the regulations work. So that's why you get Andreessen Horowitz giving Adam Neumann, or whatever his name is, another $250 million or $1 billion to do his random stuff, because that's what they always did. Like, who cares? Like, it's same money, same type of investors going to the same type of thing. So what would you expect?
Right. Yeah, don't get me started on the SEC. I feel pretty strongly about a few of their things, not the least of which is the asset-based and income-based accreditation. I feel like that doesn't make a lot of sense. And the threshold should be that you're a competent person who understands the risk that you're taking, much more so than, you know, if you've got $999,000, then you're not qualified to invest in something as deep as your expertise or knowledge might be in the vehicle or anything else. And it really seems pretty arbitrary and silly at this point, but I'm not sure if anyone's taken that on.
There was a push last year before to update the accreditation rules, and I fully agree with you. I'm like, just because you have a bunch of money doesn't mean you know what the hell you're doing,
right?
But like, and there was a push here last year, and they were like a big thing, like, oh yeah, we changed the accreditation, making it more democratic. And I looked at it, I was like, yeah, so the changes that got pushed out was pretty much the only difference was, you know, there was like initially the hearings and we contributed to these things were around, like you say, if you know what you're doing, you should be able to, you know, take the risk with your own money the way you want. But what that translated into in very classically middle of the beltway type thing is, if you have a Series 7 type exam, then you can come in. So basically, if you're like a Wall Street MBA type analyst, then and you're going to take your finance exams anyway, then you get in. And I'm like, no, the best investors in software aren't the people who are like second year analysts on Wall Street. Like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
So I agree with that. I think it's completely insane. But like, it's problematic because the way that the what we're seeing on the with this bill we're trying to introduce is we're seeing in general Republicans are for it, and in general Democrats are like worried about investor protections. And I'm like, well, you're basically stopping people who are, you already made the threshold accredited, so these are people who are already making, you know, tons of money or have tons of money,
right?
And you're telling me that like you shouldn't be able to, you're protect those are the people you're protecting from some sort of a scam. It doesn't make any sense to me. It just doesn't.
Yeah, I think a silly thing about it there, when we divide it down the red-blue party lines there too, and under the guise of protecting us from ourselves, is that I don't know if there's anything more risky than being in public markets, and you don't need any accreditation.
I mean, I look at it like I was hoping we could talk about the Wall Street Bets Reddit group here about the craziness that's on there. But it's like you could download Robinhood, you know, and YOLO your entire, you know, life savings into options on Tesla. I mean, and people do.
Yeah.
Like,
in an
it
instant.
Was literally like a week ago, there was a story. Did you hear this about the guy who like he inherited $100,000 from his father and then lost it in a day or something like that? And he was like, how do I win the money back? And I'm like,
yeah,
what? Like, yeah. Apparently that's nothing to worry about. Like you can buy super high end financial instruments for however much money you want on margin, even. Like you can borrow money to do this, no problem.
Yeah.
But if you're a sophisticated investor who understands software and wants some exposure to like non-venture B2B SaaS, no, I'm sorry. No, the government will tell you that you know, we're going to protect you from that big bogeyman.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing?
It's crazy. One of the things that I've liked over the years has been first position mortgage debt, and it's much safer than many, many, many things that you could possibly invest in. And even there, it's mostly accredited. It's just, I guess I could go on about, I'm going to show some colors, I guess, if I keep talking on that.
talk about random stuff in general.
I'd take some exception.
I mean, it's crazy to me. I mean, like also the way, just the random rules that come in, like they're starting, they changed the rules around crowdfunding, you know, like there was an Obama level bill that opened up for retail investors to do crowdfunding. But the way that those bills were written, it meant that really only kind of the weakest firms would go that route because it was so peculiar. And so that's what we're seeing now. So now there are sort of a bunch of like semi-scams that go through and ends up being crowdfunded. And the terms that are coming through are terrible because nobody understands them. And then the politicians can look at it and go like, yes, yeah, we told you all this, we're protecting you. They're all scams. But it's only because it's only the crappiest firms that go through that route.
Yeah. I'm tired of being protected. Just take off my helmet right now.
But it makes sense. I grew up in Norway and spent a bunch of time in the UK, and the rules just aren't the same. There's no such hard threshold. There's no limits like this. Now, the EU itself makes it super hard to do, you know, fund investing. We had our European fund that we're just in the process of closing now. But like we ended up, and we were like, that's a European fund. It's going to invest mostly in Europe. It makes sense to domicile it in Europe. And the rules, I mean, if it makes you feel any better, the rules for the EU were such that it was almost impossible for us to do it. So we just gave up. It was too expensive. Like everything had to be audited. It was like a $10 million fund. It's like, we were going to spend almost all our management fees in like audit compliance with an audit firm anointed by the government in Luxembourg or some crap. So we just decided to domicile it in the US. So it's kind of it's a poison all over. But then I read about these stories in like Norwegian newspapers about, you know, These people, and in Norway is a little peculiar because in Norway every year they publish the tax returns. So if you want to figure out how much money people made or like how much they're worth, you just go on a website and put their
name in. Publish everybody's tax returns.
So you can go put my name in, like and it'll say zero because I'm no longer a tax resident in Norway. But anyone in Norway, you can put, maybe even the king. I haven't tried. You could put like the name in, what they made and how much money they made, and it just shows up. And so people use this, like these scammers use it for like, you know, random real estate crap. Like there's been all these things about, you know, calling some semi, you know, Alzheimer patient who's 87 and just took all his money. And like did some deal where they're like, we have this amazing prospect. It's $25 million. And it turns out that's the same thing they bought for $2 million, like 2 months ago. Clear scams happen all the time. So, you know, there are some things to investor protections, but, you know, I think the balance is a little off in some cases.
For sure. So we're coming up on time, but I just wanted to ask if we're looking out, and nobody's got a crystal ball, but if we're looking through this quarter and into next year's, there some part of this that you're particularly excited about or else like particularly worried about in your sphere there?
Unlike you, I'm an innate optimist.
What
is, you know, what do you mean? So I'm still fully invested in the markets, unlike you. That's the difference. That you is. Know, so I think the markets is going to rip sometime next year. That's what I think. Okay. You know, but I just don't think B2B SaaS is going to be that impacted at the, currently. I think like the public market SaaS multiples are hugely deflated at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a, I don't know if I told you this, I bought SaaSmultiples.com and I'm going to turn it into like an info product site around, well, not product, but like an info site around public market multiples and that sort of thing, specifically as it relates to SaaS. But you see the public level SaaS multiples are now like 6x forward-looking revenue, which is 21x last year. And like, I look at it, I'm like, if I had more money, I don't, but if I had more money, I would put it in SaaS companies. Cause like the reduction in their income and their revenue just isn't in any way reflected on their share price. And I think eventually sometime next year, those guys are going to rip again and go up. And I think like on the M&A side, this has truly, truly been a terrible year. Last year we were seeing balls, even for smallish businesses, doing like, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times ARR selling to private equity. This year, everyone seems to be sitting on their hands, and the uncertainty means they're not even putting bids in. I think, and I don't actually understand that, just to rant a little bit of private equity software guys. On the M&A side, I spent like 5 years listening to the private equity buy side complaining about the valuations and how expensive things were getting. And then this year, when valuations are much more reasonable, nobody's doing anything. I'm like, wait, I thought you guys were all like Warren Buffett fans. Like, aren't you supposed to, like, when there's blood on the streets, when other people are fearful, blah, 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 be greedy? No, apparently not. They're all sheep. So they all follow the same thing. So nobody's buying. But that's going to change. And I think next year, we're going to be back to where we were, or maybe not quite as crazy as 2021, but back to where it makes sense to start transacting. So in general, like I said, I'm an optimist. I think now's a good time to be buying if you're buying. It's not a great time to be selling, though.
Yeah, agree. Well, that's interesting you say that, because I know, obviously, a lot of friends with software businesses, and it seems like they're all still getting calls from PE.
Anyway. Everybody's getting calls. I mean, that's nonstop. Like with, I actually have a set up a special email address. I don't know if I told you this. With the portfolio company. So whenever they get inbound, they just forward it to me and I look and I'm like, oh yeah, these are these kind of buyers, just to give them feedback on what kind of a buyer this is, whether it's worth a call and stuff. And it's stepped up, but I see the kind of people who are reaching out is more and more of the sort of bottom feeder value buyers who are like, hey, maybe you want to sell your business for, you know, a huge discount.
It can't hurt to ask.
It can't hurt to ask. And some people are, you know, they're nervous now and they're like, maybe I need to sell because it's going to get even worse. But I'm like, no, just hold on. Glory's coming.
So if somebody wants to find you and talk more about your fund or about Discretion Capital or all that, how would they find you on the web?
I'm at Einar Volset on Twitter, where I'm mostly just complaining about the Giants. Or you can go to tinyseed.com/invest. And if you fill out the form on that page, you'll come to me and I'll reach out to you. And I'm very happy to talk to anybody, even though, like I said, right now, we're probably 6 to 12 months out doing another fund. We actually also have a syndicate, which is sort of starting to ramp up, and we're doing sort of one by one deals there, which is usually a good way for new investors to get, you know, familiar with the kind of deals that we do, the kind of things we like to see. And then, on the Discretion Capital side, M&A side, discretioncapital.com, go in there and get in touch.
Okay. Well, fantastic. Thanks for coming on, man. And I hope that you and I can get back on here again and talk about some other stuff. I always appreciate your opinion, your insight, and, you know, you're really tied into
like
a lot of
what's happening. Something completely off the wall. That's what we need to talk about, like investing in watches like... What random things Einar have seen on Reddit in the last like 6 months? That would be good.
Well, I know nothing about watches. Maybe we should do an episode. You can come on here and talk to me about watches. I remember in the spring, I saw somebody on Twitter and they're like, I'm 23 and I've invested all of my money into Bitcoin and watches. And I was like, watches?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm it's set huge. For life.
I mean, honestly, yeah. I could talk about it for, I'm sort of into watches. I have too many watches, but... But yeah, no, it's been particularly crazy, particularly the combination of like the crypto mania, you know, the Bitcoin going up and stuff is very closely correlated with like people buying people, like, the joke tends to be like, you made your money in Bitcoin, you bang Lambos, but most of the time, I think it's morally more reflected in like prices for, like, you know, Rolex Submariners and things like that than it is anything else. But yeah, prices have definitely gone up. Like, it's coming down now, but for a while, if you could get a Rolex at retail, you pay $9,000 or something, you could turn around and sell it the next day for like $20,000. And so people were spending all their time like trying to make friends with these Rolex dealers to be like, hey, sell this watch to me. I mean, some of them are completely insane. You know, there's one which is I think it's a Patek Philippe. It's like a Tiffany blue dial. I don't know. Anyway, it retails for $40,000. Do you wanna guess how much it trades for in the gray market, secondhand market? $3.3 million. $3.3 million.
That's wild. That's crazy. Well, we will have to have you come back on here and talk about then, because none of that makes any sense to me. Although I have to say that I am bullish on luxury goods. I don't think anybody who can buy a $40,000 watch is really going to care about whatever's happening today, unless they're leveraged. It was awesome having you. Thanks for coming on, man. And if you want to find Einar, you find Einar Volset on Twitter or go to tinyseed.com. Thanks.